For many seconds after waking, Juba believed that the screams of the women and the whimpering of the children were all part of her nightmares, and she pulled the fur kaross over her head. Then there was a crash at the door, and it was broken down. A rush of bodies into the dark interior, and Juba came fully awake and threw off the kaross. Rough hands seized her, and though she screamed and struggled, she was dragged naked into the open. The sky was paling with the dawn, and the constables had piled fresh logs on the fire, so that Juba recognized the white man immediately, and she shrank back into the safety of the crowd of sobbing, wailing women before he could notice her. Mungo St. John was in a fury, bellowing at his sergeant, striding backwards and forwards beyond the fire, slapping his riding whip against his glossy boot. His face was flushed a dark crimson like the wattles of the waddling black Singisi, the grotesque turkey buzzard of the veldt, and his single eye blazed in the firelight. "Where are the men? I want to know, where have the men gone?" Sergeant Ezra came hurrying down the rank of cringing women, peering into their faces. He stopped in front of Juba, recognizing her instantly, one of the grand dames of the tribe. As she drew herself to her full height, even in her total and massive nudity, she was dignified and queenly. She expected some mark of respect, some gesture of courtesy from him. But instead the sergeant seized her wrist and twisted her arm up so viciously that she was forced to her knees. "Where are the Amadoda?" he hissed at her. "Where have the men gone?" Juba choked down the sob of agony in her throat and croaked, "It is true that there are no men here, for certainly the ones who wear the little brass bangles of Lodzi on their arms are not men." "Cow," hissed the sergeant. "Fat black cow." And he jerked her arm upwards, forcing her face into the dirt. "Enough, Kanka!" A voice cut through the hubbub, and the tone and power of it commanded instant silence. "Let the woman be!" Involuntarily, the sergeant released Juba and stepped back, and even Mungo St. John halted his furious pacing. Gandang stalked into the firelight, and though he wore only his head ring and a short loincloth, he was as menacing as a prowling lion, and the sergeant fell back in front of him. Juba struggled to her feet, rubbing her wrist, but Gandang did not even glance at her. He strode to Mungo St. John and asked, "What is it that you seek, white man, coming into my kraal like a thief in the night?" Mungo looked to the sergeant for a translation. "He says you are a thief," the sergeant told him, and Mungo jerked up his chin and glared at Gandang. "Tell him he knows what I came for. Tell him I want 200 strong young men." Gandang retreated immediately into the studied defensive obtuseness of Africa, which few Europeans know how to counter, and which infuriated a man like St. John, who could not even understand the language, and who had to submit to the laborious process of translation. The sun was well up when Gandang repeated the question he had first asked almost an hour before. "Why does he want my young men to come to him? They are content here," is the translation. And Mungo's clenched fists shook with the effort of restraint. "All men must work," the sergeant translated. "It is the law of the white man." "Tell him," Gandang retorted, "that it is not the way of the Matabili. The Amadoda see no dignity nor great virtue in digging in the dirt. That is for women and the Amaholi." "The Induna says that his men will not work," the sergeant translated maliciously, and Mungo St. John could endure no more of it. He took a swift pace forward and slashed the riding whip into the Induna's face. Gandang blinked, but he neither flinched nor raised his hand to touch the shining tumescent welt that rose swiftly across his cheek. He made no effort to staunch the thin trickle of blood from his crushed lip that snaked down his chin, but he let it drip onto his naked chest. "My hands are empty now, white man," he said in a whisper that was more penetrating than a bellow. "But they will not always be so." And he turned towards his hat. "Gandang!" Mungo St. John shouted after him. "Your men will work if I have to hunt them down and chain them like animals." The two girls followed the path at a smooth swinging trot that did not disturb the balance of the large bundles they carried upon their heads. In the bundles there were special gifts for their men, salt and stamped corn, snuff and beads and lengths of trade calico for loincloths that they had wheedled out of Namusa's store at Carmi Mission. They were both in high spirits, for they had passed out of the swathe of destruction left by the locust swarms, and the acacia forests were a golden yellow haze of spring bloom, murmurous with bees. Ahead of them rose the first pearly granite domes, and amongst them they would find the men. So they called gaily to each other, silly, girlish banter, and their laughter was sweet as the tinkle of bells. It carried far ahead of them. They skirted the base of a tall cliff, and without pausing to rest, started up the natural steps of grey stone. It led them upwards into a steep ravine which would eventually take them to the summit. Imbali was leading, her round, hard haunches swaying under the short skirt as she skipped over the uneven footing. And Ruth, who was every bit as eager, followed her closely into the angle where the path turned sharply between two huge round boulders that had rolled down from above. Imbali stopped so abruptly that Ruth almost ran into her, and then she hissed with alarm. A man stood in the centre of the path. Although he was unmistakably a Matabele, the girls had never seen him before. The stranger wore a blue shirt, and on his upper arm sparkled a round brass disc. In his hand he carried a rifle. Quickly Ruth glanced behind her and hissed again. Another armed man had stepped out from the shaded angle of the boulder and cut off their retreat. He was smiling, but there was nothing in that smile to reassure the girls. They lowered the bundles from their heads and shrank closer to each other. "Where are you going, pretty little kittens?" asked the smiling Kanka. "Are you going to search for a tomcat?" Neither of the girls answered. They stared at him with big frightened eyes. "We will go with you." The smiling Kanka was so broad across the chest, his legs so muscular, that he appeared to be deformed. His teeth were very white and big as those of a horse, but the smile never reached his eyes. His eyes were small and cold and dead-looking. "Lift your bundles, kittens, and lead us to the cats." Ruth shook her head. "We go only to search for medicine roots. We do not understand what you want of us." The Kanka came closer. His thick legs were bowed, and they gave him a peculiar rolling gait. Suddenly he kicked over Ruth's bundle, and it burst open. "Ah!" he smiled coldly. "Why do you carry such gifts if you go to search for Muti?" Ruth dropped to her knees and scrabbled amongst the rocks to retrieve the spilled corn and scattered beads. The Kanka dropped his hand onto her back and stroked her lustrous black skin. "Purr, little kitten," he grinned, and Ruth froze, crouched at his feet with her hands filled with spilled grain. The Kanka ran his fingers lightly up and placed his hand upon the nape of her neck. His hand was huge, the knuckles enlarged, the fingers thick and powerful. Ruth began to tremble as the fingers encircled her neck. The Kanka looked up at his companion, who still guarded the pathway, and the two of them exchanged a glance. Imbali saw and understood. "She is a bride," she whispered. "Her husband is the nephew of Gandang. Take care, Kanka." The man ignored her. He lifted Ruth to her feet by the neck and twisted her face towards him. "Take us to where the men are hiding." Ruth stared at him silently for a second, and then suddenly and explosively she spat into his face. The frothy spittle spattered his cheeks and dripped from his chin. "Kanka," she hissed. "Traitor jackal." The man never stopped smiling. "That is what I wanted you to do," he told her, and hooked his finger into the string of her skirt and snapped it. The skirt fell around her ankles. He held her by the scruff, and she struggled and covered her groin with both hands. The Kanka looked at her naked body, and his breathing changed. "Watch the other," he told his companion, and tossed his Winchester rifle to him. The second constable caught it by the stock and prodded Imbali with the barrel, until she backed up against the high granite boulder. "Our time will come very soon," he assured her, and turned his head to watch the other couple, at the same time holding Imbali pinned against the rock. The Kanka dragged Ruth off the path, but for only a few paces, and the scrub that screened them was thin and leafless. "My man will kill you," cried Ruth. They could hear everything on the path, even the sound of the Kanka's ragged breathing. "Then give me good value if I must pay with my life," he chuckled, and then gasped with pain. "Oh, so, kitten, you have sharp claws." And there was the clap of a blow on soft flesh, the sound of struggling. The bushes heaved, and loose pebbles rolled away down the slope. The constable guarding Imbali strained for a glimpse of what was happening. His lips were open, and he licked them. He could make out blurred movement through the leafless branches, and then there was the sound of a body falling heavily to earth, and the breath being driven violently from Ruth's lungs by a crushing weight. "Hold still, kitten," the Kanka panted. "You make me angry. Lie still." And abruptly Ruth screamed. It was the shrill, ringing cry of an animal in mortal agony, repeated again and again, and the Kanka grunted. "Yes, there, yes, yes, yes," and then snuffed like a boar at the trough, and there was a soft, rhythmic slapping sound, and Ruth kept screaming. The man guarding Imbali propped the spare rifle against the boulder and stepped off the path, and with the barrel of his own Winchester parted the branches and stared. His face seemed to swell and darken with passion, his whole attention concentrated on what he was watching. With the second constable's attention so distracted, Imbali sidled along the granite and then paused for an instant to gather herself before darting away. She had reached the angle of the pathway before the man turned and saw her. "Come back!" he shouted. "What is it?" the Kanka demanded from behind the bushes in a thick, tortured voice. "The other one, she is running." "Stop her," the Kanka bellowed, and his companion ran to the corner. Imbali was 50 paces down the hillside, flying like a gazelle over the rough ground, driven by her terror. The man thumbed back the hammer of his Winchester, flung the butt to his shoulder, and fired wildly without aiming. It was a fluke shot. It caught the girl in the small of the back, and the big soft lead slug tore out through her belly. She collapsed and rolled down the steep pathway, her limbs tumbling about loosely. The constable lowered the rifle. His expression was shocked and unbelieving. Slowly, hesitantly, he went down to where the girl lay. She was on her back. Her eyes were open, and the exit wound in her flat young stomach gaped hideously. Her torn entrails bulged from it. The girl's eyes switched to his face. The terror in them flared up for an instant, and then slowly faded into utter blankness. She is dead. The Kanka had left Ruth and come down the path. He had left his apron in the bushes. His blue shirt tails flapped around his bare legs. Both of them stared down at the dead girl. "I did not mean it," said the Kanka, with the hot rifle in his hands. "We cannot let the other one go back to tell what has happened," his companion replied, and turned back up the pathway. As he passed, he picked up his own rifle from where it leaned against the rock. He stepped off the path, behind the thin screen of bushes. The other man was still staring into Imbali's blank eyes when the second shot rang out. He flinched to the crack of it, and lifted his head. As the echoes lapped away amongst the granite cliffs, the Kanka stepped back onto the path. He ejected the spent cartridge case from the breech, and it pinged against the rock. "Now we must find a story for One Bright Eye, and for the Indunas," he said quietly, and strapped the fur apron back around his thick waist. They brought the two girls back to Gundung's kraal on the back of the police sergeant's grey horse. Their legs dangled down one side and their arms down the other. They had wrapped a grey blanket around their naked bodies, as though ashamed of the wounds upon them. But the blood had soaked through and dried black upon it. and the big metallic green flies swarmed joyously upon the stains.